This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, traveler. Can you handle the truth? I didn't think so. Me neither. But it will happen anyway. Science is beginning to prove we have already changed the planet's climate in dangerous ways. A small group of climate scientists, backed by a billionaire and big oil, are considering taking over control of the climate to stave off disaster. Then we'll find proof our current 400 parts per million will melt so much Arctic and Antarctic ice, warming up to 8 degrees C, that global coasts will flood the world's largest cities. We'll wrap up with one of the few positive alternatives growing in this disturbed scene, a wake of bike sharing around the world. It can work. Gather round, boys and girls, as we tell the story of Earthmasters, the men who would take over from nature to run the climate of the world. Or do they mean to save us from our fossil-addicted selves? For all who love a good conspiracy, geoengineering has it all, the oil companies, far-right think tanks, nuclear weapons scientists, and even Bill Gates. But you have to hang in a little bit while we first look at a few small problems in their plans. Our guide is Clive Hamilton. After careers in the Australian Public Service as an economics and resource advisor and several stints at universities like Yale, Cambridge, and Oxford, Hamilton founded and ran a progressive think tank called the Australia Institute. Now he's professor of public ethics in a program run by two Australian universities. You may have heard of books Clive has written or co-written, including Growth Fetish, Affluenza, Silencing Dissent, and more recently, Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. But his latest book is Earthmasters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering. We've reached Clive Hamilton in Canberra. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
Well, it's good to connect with you, and I begin maybe a little facetiously by saying your book is full of some great news. It's a real relief. We just have to pump a bit of sea salt into the air and we can go on burning fossil fuels as before, even if we double the CO2 in the atmosphere. What are some scientists proposing to stop global warming? Try and make a little case for them.
Well, the idea of geoengineering has now come onto the international climate change agenda because the climate scientists themselves became very worried at the failure of the world to respond to their warnings. So the argument is that if Plan A, reducing global greenhouse gas emissions, isn't working, shouldn't we have Plan B? And that's where they started to develop these geoengineering ideas, a whole string of technologies that would either suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere or to put some kind of solar shield between the Earth and the Sun to cool the planet by basically reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches planet Earth.
Well, it's that latter one I want to talk to you most about, solar radiation management. Who named it that, and did he come up with another name for it?
Well, there's one of the more prominent scientists involved in researching geoengineering, Ken Caldera at Stanford University, came up with the term solar radiation management, although more recently he's decided that perhaps sunlight reflection methods would be a term that would less likely frighten the horses. He came up with that term, he wrote, because talking about geoengineering would be too scary for some bureaucrats, and he was wanted to get some money to hold a seminar at NASA. And he was worried that geoengineering or climate engineering might make them a bit afraid. So he came up with his idea of solar radiation management. But of course, as soon as you think about it, managing the amount of solar radiation which reaches planet Earth, I mean, that's a pretty scary thought. And when you consider the primary method that is being put forward, it becomes scarier. And that method is essentially to surround the entire Earth in the upper atmosphere with a layer of so-called sulfate aerosols, tiny particles, essentially a kind of pollution, same kind of pollution that causes acid rain, but this time way, way up in the stratosphere. And because it's a pollution, these tiny particles would basically, depending on how much you put up there, reduce the amount of incoming solar radiation by perhaps 1 or 2%, thereby cooling the planet.
Isn't that the same as happens when volcanoes go off?
It is, and in fact, the idea for sulfate aerosol spraying as a method of geoengineering was prompted by observations over 100 years or more of the impact on the Earth's climate of major volcanic eruptions. Mount Pinatubo, for example, in 1991 in the Philippines, was a massive eruption, and it put so much volcanic ash and other particles and soot into the atmosphere that once it had circled the globe, it cooled the planet for half a degree or more for a couple of years. So that gave rise to the idea of, well, what if we could control the amount of this kind of sulfate aerosol in the upper atmosphere, say, with a fleet of specially equipped aircraft that would go up on a regular basis and spray the precursor chemical, sulfur dioxide or sulfuric acid, which would then in the upper atmosphere form sulfate particles and basically put a kind of thin shield around the Earth, which then whoever controlled it could turn up or down to offset the impacts of warming due to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Well, right, but then the next point you raise, I believe you used the term spine chilling, is what happens if we succeed in cooling the planet but then can't manage to keep the program going. You used the year 2059, I believe. What happens?
Well, this is one of a string of fairly frightening possibilities arising from sulfate aerosol spraying. A lot of modelling work has been done using big global climate models, but there has been no testing of it yet. One of the difficulties is that if we did, we, the global community, and, you know, there is a question whether it would be the global community that did it or one power, China or United States maybe, but if we, the global community, decided to do it, we would need to do it for at least 10 years before we had enough data to be able to separate out the effects of sulfate aerosol spraying from the effects of global warming and natural climate variability. But building on that, the whole point about solar radiation management is it's not trying to counter human-induced climate change, but simply to deal with one of the symptoms. Okay, so one of the symptoms of human-induced climate change, and you know, the main one, is a warming globe. And so rather than tackle the source of the problem, that is burning fossil fuels and putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, sulfate aerosol spraying would try to counter one of the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So basically it's suppressing the warming that's happening. It's countering it by putting this solar shield around the Earth. And so the question is, well, if we had to stop, if we had to take down the solar shield for some reason, maybe there was a really big unintended consequence, like it had a major effect, negative effect on rainfall patterns around the world, or let's say there's a big international conflict about the solar shield and it was stopped. We stopped sending the planes up, we stopped spraying the sulfate aerosols, and within a year or so, all of these sulfur particles fall out of the upper atmosphere. The problem is that we'll then have decades and decades of suppressed warming. Let's say we turned it off in 2060. We'd have decades of suppressed warming as we continue to pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, if indeed we did do that, and then there would be a huge rush of this warming that would happen very, very quickly. And as you know, the damage to ecosystems from global warming is due more to the rapidity of warming rather than the amount of warming, because if it's faster warming, ecosystems have less time to adapt. So this whole question is called the termination problem. Could we, once we'd started, could we actually terminate it, or would we be locked into this solar radiation management virtually in perpetuity?
Right, for generations to come. You mentioned rainfall, and you go into some detail in the book Earthmasters about the possibilities of rainfall changing in big ways. Could you talk to us for a minute about that?
Well, one of the big rainfall or precipitation events in the global climate system is, of course, the so-called Indian monsoon, which happens with great regularity each year and which is obviously crucial to irrigated agriculture over a vast swathe of the Indian subcontinent. And so a billion or more people depend on the Indian monsoon for their food supplies. One of the modelling studies using these global climate models looked at the impact on precipitation around the world of sulphate aerosol spraying and concluded that it's possible that the change to the global weather patterns as a result of sulphate aerosol spraying would be to shift the Indian monsoon, essentially from over India, Pakistan, sort of southwest over more towards Africa. And if that were to happen, of course, there would be a great drought in those regions and potentially severe effects on food supplies. I should say other modelling studies have suggested that that probably won't happen. But the fact that this is a possibility really opens up some very worrying implications and really points to the question of, well, who would control the global climate? And this question of governance, we're not even at that stage of thinking seriously about it yet. But given that global warming is continuing apace, the growth of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is accelerating, the prospect of engineering the climate is a very real one, and it's time now, and in a way this is why I wrote my book Earthmasters, for the world community to get involved so that if a time does come where it's seriously considered to take control of the Earth's climate, then it's not just the powerful few that have a say, but the world community as a whole.
Yeah, should it be Dick Cheney or perhaps the leader of North Korea? It's pretty hard to decide who in this world is ready to control the climate. Why can't we experiment with this first in some faraway part of the world to see whether the theory works?
For other geoengineering techniques, and I should say that sulfate aerosol spraying is kind of the headline technology, but there are a number of others which are being tested in various ways, less scary ones in some cases. But sulfate aerosol spraying, really, you can't test it because to see what effect it would have on the global weather patterns and certainly on the Earth's temperature, you can't do an experiment. You have to actually do it. You have to do the lot. You have to put up the sulfate aerosol shield and see what happens. So if you just went up over the ocean somewhere and sprayed some sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere, I mean, it might be very valuable telling you something about the chemistry of the upper atmosphere and whether the aerosols do form and in the way anticipated, but you couldn't find out what impact sulfate aerosol spraying would have on the global climate, on warming, on precipitation, on the ozone layer, for example, without actually implementing the scheme as a whole. So if we ever do it, it will be a gamble because we'll never really know with a great degree of confidence how it will work until we've actually done it.
Clive, does that mean we can't do regional climate control? Like, for example, some are advocating we could do it to save the Arctic sea ice.
No, well, some are advocating that. I mean, some serious people are advocating that. Not only are they advocating it, they're saying we should be doing it now. We should be doing it to slow down or prevent the melting of the sea ice in the Arctic. The problem, of course, is that if you go up there in the Arctic, high up, and spray sulfate aerosols, well, you know, they soon start blowing around the world and dispersing, and so you have to have a continuing program of spraying sulfate aerosols over the Arctic, which protects the Arctic for a while, but you know, very soon, within days or weeks, it gets blown around the world. And so it's very difficult to really isolate a particular area and to concentrate the activity on deflecting solar radiation from a particular part of the world.
This is Radio EcoShock with Clive Hamilton, an Australian intellectual and author of the new book, Earthmasters. I'm Alex Smith, and yes, we are talking about geoengineering to save the world, maybe. Clive, there's an old saying, you can't tell the players without a program. Your book has a pretty good outline of the people and institutions championing man-made climate control. Why not tell us about two of the key movers, Ken Caldera, who you've mentioned, and David Keith? Who are they?
Ken Caldera and David Keith are extremely well-regarded and accomplished climate scientists. Ken Caldera, as I mentioned, is at Stanford, and David Keith is at Harvard, formerly at the University of Calgary for many years. And they are extremely active in the geoengineering research arena, to the point where an earlier author dubbed them the geo-clique. And they are extremely active. They're very concerned about climate change, and which is why they are investigating geoengineering. Although, as I explain in the book, I think both of them have some kind of odd attitudes to global climate change. But one of the reasons why they're so important is that some years ago they became the principal advisors on climate change to Bill Gates. And Bill Gates was so impressed with their intelligence and commitment that he allocated several million dollars to a fund to conduct research into geoengineering technologies. So Caldera and Keith have been administering this fund for research, and it has also led, their influence has led Bill Gates himself to start investing in a number of companies which developing geoengineering technologies. One of them, for example, one of the companies that he's associated with is called Intellectual Ventures. The CEO is a man called Nathan Myhrvold, who was formerly the chief technology officer at Microsoft. Another man associated with Intellectual Ventures is named Lowell Wood. Now, Lowell Wood is an extremely interesting character. He was for many years, decades, until he left fairly recently, one of the gurus of weapons research, nuclear weapons research, at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the two major Cold War weapons research laboratories. Livermore is located outside San Francisco. Lowell Wood was the protege of Edward Teller, the so-called father of the hydrogen bomb and one of the foremost Cold War architects. And so Lowell Wood and Edward Teller were responsible not only for Star Wars, the ill-fated venture for a missile shield, which the US could use space-based missile shield to defend against or indeed attack the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But they also, in the late 1990s, Lowell Wood and Edward Teller wrote one of the very first papers on geoengineering. And so in the book, I investigate the kind of links between geoengineering and Cold War thinking. If you reflect on it a bit, here we have with geoengineering, potentially at least, a vast technological plan to take control of planet Earth. This is in the grander designs. There are much more localized and benign forms of geoengineering to which this kind of analysis doesn't apply. But when it comes to sulfate aerosol spraying, you've got what I call a sort of Promethean vision to use technology to control nature, not just bits of nature, not just ecosystems or a river system or, you know, with a dam or something like that, or to carve out new ports using nuclear explosions, which Edward Teller was very keen to do, but to actually take control using technology of the planet's operating system in its entirety. And so in a way, this is my main concern, that in some parts of the geoengineering community, there is this Promethean ambition for control. I should say that there are others in the United States, and more particularly in Europe, who take a very different view of geoengineering. Even though they support research into geoengineering, they're far more humble, far more circumspect, far more worried about unintended consequences and the political misuse of geoengineering. So in a way, there's a kind of split within the geoengineering community between those who are very worried, in fact terrified about climate change and think with heavy hearts that we have to investigate Plan B, and others who get very excited about Plan B because they see it as the opportunity for mankind, and I use the word deliberately, to use our unique position, our technological genius, to finally take control of the Earth and subdue it.
Ah, we become the Earth Masters. Well, there's others waiting in the wings. I could see how this would really benefit the oil companies. They could keep on selling their products. What multinational oil companies are already involved in the geoengineering scene?
Well, of course, your companies and other fossil fuel companies realize they have to be very careful here because, like national governments that could be reducing carbon dioxide emissions but aren't or are only pretending to, the oil companies can be accused of trying to essentially torpedo Plan A, reducing carbon dioxide emissions, by promoting this bright, shiny Plan B. Nevertheless, the oil companies have quietly started to take an interest in geoengineering. ExxonMobil, for example, and there's no company or indeed organisation in the world that's done more to try to undermine the credibility of climate science and to stop nations, particularly the US, from adopting policies to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But ExxonMobil has an expert named Haroon Keshki, has an expert in geoengineering who's quietly been participating in task forces which looking at geoengineering and advocating more research. Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, is supporting research into geoengineering technology known as ocean liming. ConocoPhillips is supporting in Africa and elsewhere another geoengineering technology called biochar, a more benign technology compared to sulfate aerosol spraying, much more benign, and a lot of environmentalists support biochar. But the fact that ConocoPhillips is putting quite a lot of money into developing biochar as a kind of plan B for global warming certainly should set some alarm bells ringing.
Even the American Enterprise Institute, which took big oil money to deny climate change for years, has come out in favor of geoengineering, you write, for what? For a problem that doesn't exist? Help me, Clive, my brain is melting trying to make this connect.
It is very bizarre, isn't it? Until you start to think about it more carefully. So here we have these right-wing think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, which for a decade or more has been actively working to repudiate, undermine, deny climate change science. And whenever any measure, state or national, to reduce carbon dioxide emissions has been put forward, has embarked on a campaign to attack it for all usual right-wing reasons about government control and environmentalist secret agenda and so on and so forth. And so here you have them, nevertheless, supporting geoengineering. And the reason for it is that geoengineering sort of reverses the whole problem of human-induced climate change. Geoengineering, when it's put forward as a substitute for cutting carbon emissions, promises to turn a drastic failure of the free enterprise system into a triumph of human ingenuity. So instead of climate change being a vindication, a terrible vindication of the warnings of environmentalists, geoengineering exposes the lack of faith of environmentalists in humanity's ability to use its technology to solve these problems. So for organizations like the American Enterprise Institute, geoengineering doesn't represent the danger of technological hubris, but is an expression of human mastery over nature. So you can see how geoengineering, as opposed to reducing carbon dioxide emissions and shifting to renewable energy technologies, represents an affirmation of their view of the world, of humankind, of the free enterprise system. It's a sort of bizarre twist. So here we have these organizations which for years have been vigorously arguing that there is no such thing as human-induced climate change, and then along come these proposals for geoengineering as a response to human-induced climate change. They say, that's the kind of cure to a problem which we previously said didn't exist, but that's the kind of cure we're willing to swallow. So let's have some.
We are talking with author Clive Hamilton about his new book, Earth Masters, and due to time limitations, we won't be going into the technologies to suck carbon dioxide out of the air. People, you're going to have to buy the book to get that. But Clive, I would love to see you write a series of popular articles from this book to get these facts out more widely, or have you already done that?
I've done a few, and they can be found on the internet. I'm also going to be doing a tour in the United States and Canada in the next two or three weeks, and so I imagine more of those kinds of articles will be appearing in easily accessible formats for people.
His website is clivehamilton.com. The book is Earth Masters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering from Yale University Press. I admit it made me so angry at one point I had to toss it down partway through and go out for a walk. But Clive, you're very patient as you explain some of these kind of crazy things that are going on.
Behind the scenes, it's gathering a lot of momentum as the climate science becomes more alarming and we go into a next warming spike. The calls to geoengineer the planet will become public and loud, and we need a really vigorous public debate so that it's not left to the powerful to protect their interests at the expense of everyone else.
Listeners, now it's up to you to spread the word about this and get people educated, because in his book, Clive shows polls that say most people don't even know this is happening, that the debate is even happening, and we need to know more about it. I'm Alex Smith. I highly recommend you follow up with Clive Hamilton's book, Earth Masters. Thank you so much, Clive.
Thanks, Alex.
In the last year, scientists discovered a climate record going back over 3 million years, long beyond the ice core records of 800,000 years. Research led by Professor Julie Brigham Grett from the University of Massachusetts Amherst drastically changes our understanding of the world. Drilling into a lake in the Russian Arctic created from a meteor strike ages ago, she found several periods, where the Arctic was up to 8 degrees warmer than today. That despite carbon dioxide levels thought to be similar to or below today's 400 parts per million. The Greenland ice sheets have repeatedly shrunk to half their current size. The West Antarctic ice sheet completely disappeared 1.1 million years ago. The sea level was tens of meters higher than today. Here is a selection of key clips recorded from a YouTube video presentation by Dr. Julie Brigham Grett at Amherst in the summer of 2012, almost a year ago, and yet hardly anyone has heard of these startling findings.
So everything you see here in this diagram from stage 5 on is absolutely new. No one's ever seen this before in the Arctic in a continuous record from the land. We know from looking at this stage 5 here, 125,000 years ago, the Arctic was a little warmer than now. Globally, we were 1 or 2 degrees warmer than present. The Arctic may have been 2 or 3 or 4 degrees warmer than present. And scientists agree now that the Greenland ice sheet at that time was probably 40 to 50% of its present size. So we can see what the Arctic does in a warmer world. So let's look at stage 11 at 410,000 years ago. And if we take this little interval right here and expand it out, this goes from 450,000 to 380,000 years here. So we've blown up stage 11. So let's look at that in terms of the vegetation around there. And on the left, I have color-coded. The red here is just trees and shrubs. When there's lots of trees in the Arctic, you know it's got to be warm. And the cooler intervals here in blue. So this is, again, stage 11. This is the pollen, preservation of the pollen that records the vegetation at the time by Pat Anderson at the University of Washington and Tolya Loshkin in Magadan. Their pollen records then have been transferred into a biomodel by Pavel Terezov, which allows us then to reconstruct paleo temperatures. And what this shows is that through the interval of stage 11, the climate was in fact 8 degrees warmer than present in summer. That's astounding. Nobody's ever seen this before. So this was astounding that it, not only was it warm, it was warmer than 5E when that previous interglacial. This is not what we had expected.
This is Radio EcoShock. In just a minute, we'll return with more from Amherst Professor Julie Brigham Grett as the Arctic reveals secrets of previous ages of extreme warming.